dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We have a war underway here on the home front. It is political warfare, primarily, and it is much in evidence at the moment in the House of Representatives, where, as we speak, the Judiciary Committee is in the full throes of recommending articles of impeachment to the full House and will presumably do so about the time that this program goes on air. To take stock of what on earth is going on and specifically what the basis is for these articles for impeachment and specifically whether they rise to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors that justify impeachment, I couldn't be more pleased to have a man whose acumen on such subjects is practically unsurpassed, as far as I'm concerned, certainly here in the Washington arena. He is Hans von Spakovsky. We call him HVS for short. These days, he is the senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation's Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, but he has in his resume some extraordinarily important credentials, including service as a member of the Federal Election Commission and as a counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights at the Department of Justice. He's taught as an adjunct professor, and he is an extraordinarily and very highly accomplished contributor to the public policy debate in various media outlets, including, of course, this one. Hans, it's so good to have you with us. Thank you for taking some time to talk us through what is, as I say, going on at the moment on Capitol Hill with respect to impeachment.
Well, it's great to be back with you. As you know, hearings are going on. The House Judiciary Committee is debating and arguing about impeachment. Look, the bottom line here is this. This was actually, I think, best expressed in the Judiciary Committee hearing they had with the four law professors. The only law professor that actually made sense on this was the guy named Professor Turley, well-known liberal, has admitted he didn't vote for Trump, doesn't like Trump, but has said the record simply has not been established by Democrats. They have not brought forward the evidence or facts that would justify impeachment. And that is the bottom line here. It certainly, I've never seen a weaker set of articles of impeachment. The ones that they released recently that claimed abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Mm.
I want to drill down on both of those. But speaking of Jonathan Turley, I did want to just say at the outset, Hans, that Jonathan suggested, as you've just conveyed, that the evidentiary basis for this impeachment procedure is so weak and the process itself is so flawed that there is an abuse of power underway, but it's actually the Congress that's culpable of it, not the president.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think that's entirely true. It's important for people to understand the bottom line here, which is that we are not a parliamentary system. The impeachment provision was not put into the Constitution to allow members of Congress to remove a president because they don't like him personally, in this case.
A vote of no confidence in the parliamentary parlance, right?
Right, right. The impeachment process is not to be used because you don't like the president or members of Congress don't like his policies. That's what elections are for. The impeachment process is only for serious misconduct by the president, breaking and violating federal law, engaging in bribery or treason. And they failed to prove any of that. As you know, during the hearings, there was all these grandiose claims by Democrats that the president had engaged in extortion, bribery. Well, you'll notice none of those claims are in the proposed articles of impeachment. And that's because they didn't pull forward any facts or evidence showing or proving extortion or bribery or quid pro quo, which they quickly dropped because the average person has no idea what that means. So instead, they come up with abuse of power. Well, abuse of power, why? Well, they're claiming that he, in his discussions with Ukraine, was trying to get Ukraine to engage in conduct that would interfere with the 2020 election. Well, I'm sorry, but you can look at the transcription of the phone call between the president and President Trump and the president of Ukraine, and that's just not there. So again, it's just an extremely weak case. And the second one, obstruction of Congress, that is an absurd claim. They're in essence saying that the president doesn't have the right to shield and protect the confidentiality of his discussions and communications with his closest advisors. Well, excuse me, but that is called executive privilege, and it's been a recognized constitutional doctrine since George Washington. And it is not a basis for impeaching the president.
Right. And more to the point, the president has properly gone to the judicial branch in connection with adjudicating this question of whether or not the privilege extends to these people and so on. And that's what apparently the House is suggesting is somehow obstructing Congress. I mean, Hans, you are deeply knowledgeable about the separation of powers and, you know, the operation of the Constitution, as well as, you know, a man with considerable experience in the executive branch. I mean, this seems on the face of it to be ludicrous.
I think that's the proper analysis of it. It is ludicrous. I mean, to say that the president going to court, going to the third branch, the judicial branch, to have them decide whether subpoenas being issued by Congress are beyond Congress's authority, that is an impeachable offense, is just it's an unbelievable betrayal of our entire constitutional system of government. And it really makes you realize that this is a political witch hunt. It is not based on anything real. And as I think it was Al Green, the representative from Texas, admitted quite a while ago, when he said, well, we've got to impeach the president because otherwise he might win the 2020 election.
Right. I think Adam Schiff, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, who's been the principal driver behind all of this craziness, I think has said the same even more recently. This is, I wouldn't call it political witch hunt so much as it's political warfare. This is designed, and it was, as a constitutional scholar like yourself knows so well, as best I can tell, exactly what the founders were trying to ensure didn't happen with the carefully constructed approach that they had, notably the fact that the Senate has to vote 2/3 majority to actually convict should an indictment in the form of an impeachment be issued. Hans, we have to take a brief break. Much more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Okay. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're visiting with a distinguished legal practitioner as well as scholar. These days, the senior legal fellow at the Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the highly regarded Heritage Foundation. His name is Hans von Spakovsky, or HVS for short. Hans, you have written extensively on many of the subjects that bear on this question, but I know it's also a matter of prognostication, shall we say, a crystal ball reading. I was visiting yesterday with a mutual friend of ours, who I think I'll have to go unnamed because it was a private conversation, but he was speculating, in fact, felt rather strongly, that despite all of the smart money, the conventional wisdom being that Nancy Pelosi is determined to get this impeachment vote done and done quickly, jam it through, that they won't in the end do it. They won't in the end actually vote. Her Democratic caucus will not muster the majority that they need, without any help from Republicans, of course, but the majority that they need, principally because those, I think, 31 members of the House who were elected in the last cycle in districts that Donald Trump carried aren't going to go for it, or aren't going to go for it in sufficient numbers to make the difference in any event. And secondly, that it's obvious to anybody with a lick of sense, and she does have some sense, Nancy Pelosi, that this is for naught, that the Senate is not going to convict, especially on the basis of the problems that you've identified. Could that possibly be, or do you think that we're going to see the president impeached because they're determined to impeach him at whatever cost to their own caucus and its prospects for holding the House next year?
I'm afraid it's the latter. Look, if rationality prevailed, and an adherence to constitutional principles, in other words, trying to remain faithful to the Constitution despite your political differences with the other side of the political aisle, then yeah, they would not vote this in. But I'm afraid that they are so emotionally involved in this almost unbelievable hatred for the president and absolutely everything he does, and a very personal hatred, I'm afraid they are going to go through with it. I mean, you know, remember, Frank, we used to joke about Bush derangement syndrome when George Bush was president and the irrational reactions to him. Bush derangement syndrome, Trump derangement syndrome, makes Bush derangement syndrome look like the difference between a mild cold and pneumonia.
Yes. Mark Twain used to say lightning and lightning bugs. It's really amazing. Having said that, Hans, let me just ask you, one of the things that seemingly is now becoming the narrative of the left and the House Democrats as their mouthpieces is that come whatever may of this impeachment exercise, and presumably that we won't see him convicted in the Senate if he is impeached by the House, the election is nonetheless going to be invalid, even if he, again, is acquitted. They're beginning to build this new meme that they've trumpeted, of course, endlessly about the 2016 election, that it was invalid. And now it's going to be the 2020 election that is illegitimate because. What are your thoughts about this and its implications?
Well, this is a sign of their desperation. They can push that narrative forward. I don't think the public is going to buy it. This is nationalizing the narrative that Stacey Abrams, the losing Democratic gubernatorial candidate in Georgia in 2018, has been using to claim that Republican there, Brian Kemp, was an illegitimate winner of that election because of, you know, all these crazy claims of voter suppression, et cetera. Those claims were completely absurd. They have been proven to be totally wrong. Turnout, in fact, went to record highs in Georgia. Stacey Abrams lost not because of voter suppression, but because she couldn't convince enough people to vote for her. But she has been using that claim, and if you can believe it, Michael Bloomberg just announced he's giving her $5 million to her organization there to keep pushing those kind of crazy claims. And obviously, they now want to nationalize that same kind of thing and have it ready to go if they lose the 2020 election to Donald Trump.
Yeah. I fear that the consequences will be further division in this country, and who knows, perhaps even violence in response. It's a frightening thing they're playing with there. And let me, before we run out of time with you, just switch gears to two other topics that I know you've been following closely as well. Michael Horowitz, the Inspector General of your old Department of Justice, issued yet another report, this one involving his assessment of what was going on with respect to the FBI's practice in investigating Donald Trump's campaign, specifically what it did with respect to the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court. Give us your quick take on what was said in that report and the response to it, notably by the current Attorney General of the United States, William Barr.
That 500-page report is the most devastating, shocking report about the FBI that I've seen in my lifetime. And in essence, the IG found such a glaring series of errors, mistakes, and omissions by the FBI that make it clear that the FBI misled the FISA court, refused to provide exculpatory facts and evidence that it had almost from the very beginning to the FISA court that showed that the theory under which it was operating was totally bogus. And it's very clear that if, in fact, the FBI had not misled and frankly lied to the FISA courts, they would never have obtained the warrants they did obtain to start the electronic eavesdropping and spying on Carter Page and the Trump campaign.
Now, clearly, you've read a different report than most of the reporters who have described this report. What I've been hearing from them, and I think the American people have, is there was no evidence of political motivation behind any of the things that you've just recounted, Hans. Did you read it that way?
They're misinterpreting one line in a 500-page report. And what the IG said was that he didn't find documentary or testimonial evidence of political bias. Well, what that means is that none of the FBI agents they interviewed would admit in their testimony that they did something because they hated Donald Trump, and they didn't put it documentary evidence. They didn't put it in any of their emails. But right after that, the IG says, I did not receive a satisfactory explanation for the very serious failures and misfeasance of the FBI. So you have a choice. Either they were politically biased against the president, decisions they made, or they were these top flight people who are in charge of our counterintelligence, they were legally incompetent. Well, which is
malfeasant or incompetence? Well, it's interesting, Hans, and I'm so glad that you've added that important context, because I'm fearful that most of us are thinking that this 500-page devastating report, as you put it, is just another in a series of Michael Horowitz specials that that failed to find real fault with those who were responsible for what I consider to be the anti-Trump conspiracy or coup. And if that's not so, I hope that Lindsey Graham is going to actually get to the bottom of this and amplify that further. I know he had hearings yesterday. Any thoughts on those hearings and the takeaway there?
Well, those hearings, again, were quite something. And in fact, it's very clear from the questions that were asked and Horowitz's answers that the FBI, in essence, carried out an illegal spying operation on the Trump campaign. Because it's clear from what Horowitz said and from the glaring errors and mistakes he found and the omissions of the FBI, like I said, that they misled the FISA court. And the FISA court would never have authorized them to even start this investigation of the president, and they certainly would not have agreed to the renewals, the three renewals after that, of the surveillance warrants. So the FBI has a lot to answer for, and their reputation has been damaged to such an extent that I don't know how they're ever going to repair it.
Wow. And we've heard from both the Attorney General and John Durham, the U.S. Attorney in Connecticut, who is conducting what we're told is now a criminal investigation, that they're taking a very, very serious look at this report and do not find that there's no reason to be concerned about the impetus behind it. Is that your reading as well?
Oh, yeah. John Durham put out a statement saying that while he had great respect for Horowitz, he did not agree with Horowitz's take on the opening up of this investigation. And the difference, of course, is all the IG can do is audit internally personnel at the FBI and DOJ. John Durham is not limited in that way. In fact, he said he's been speaking to and interviewing people both inside and outside of the United States. And it's very, very significant that he turned what was at first an inquiry into a criminal investigation. That tells you a lot.
We'll be watching it closely, as I know will you, my friend. Thank you very much, Hans, for taking the time to walk us through some of these rather opaque issues, or at least confusing, especially as they are being reported to the rest of us. We appreciate your work at the Heritage Foundation, as well as your two really important books, Who's Counting and Obama's Enforcer. Keep up the good work. Come back, my friend. We'll talk with you soon. Next up, we'll speak with Diana West to get her take on this latest round of the impeachment cabal and the coup, of which it is an important part. That and more right after this.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. One of the high points of our week here at Secure Freedom Radio, of course, is our visits just about every week with Diana West, longtime syndicated columnist and blogger par excellence. You can find her writings at dianawest.net. She's also the author of three superb books, Death of the Grown-Up, American Betrayal, and most recently, The Red Thread, The Search for Ideological Drivers in the Anti-Trump Conspiracy. And the anti-Trump conspiracy is much in evidence at the moment, Diana West, as we were just speaking about with Hans von Spakovsky, in terms of the impeachment fandango that is underway on Capitol Hill as we speak. Give us your latest read on what is happening there and what you make of it.
Well, this is a show impeachment, just as history tells us about show trials, where evidence doesn't exist and is faked, and a court process or an impeachment process goes through as an imitation of due process or anything real. I mean, this is a projection on a screen for the American people to watch, for the Democrats to try to figure out their next move. And I think really, and we've discussed this before, we are looking at a sequential outburst or the next episode of this ongoing conspiracy against first Donald Trump's campaign, his election, his transition, his presidency, and now, of course, we're moving toward the future and looking at this same action directed against his hoped for re-election. So this is all of a piece, and I think an awful lot of people, Americans, are understanding it that way. We just have to see how it unspools in going forward. What next?
Yeah. Well, one of the things we're being told by a number of the House Democrats is that they're going to just keep on trying to impeach him, even if this one doesn't pan out, which is another scandal that speaks to, as we discussed a little bit with Hans a moment ago, Diana, this notion that really what we're dealing with is political warfare. This is about removing him from power, the anti-Trump conspiracy, the cabal, the coup, whatever one wishes to call it. It's very much in evidence. It's just that they're hijacking constitutional mechanisms for this purpose and dressing it all up as though they're the defenders of the Constitution. It is fraudulent on so many fronts. But when you look at what has now transpired in terms of the evidence and the actual impeachment charges, Diana, do you come away, as did Hans, and for that matter so do I, persuaded that this is pathetic, really, in terms of the complete inadequacy of even the show of a show trial.
Right, right. Well, absolutely. But that is sort of the evil core of this, that this is so fake, so fraudulent, but it's the the hijacking of not just the constitutional mechanisms, but the airwaves. And so this is where you realize that we are, yes, this is even more than political warfare. I mean, this is a kind of civil war that we're undergoing. It's a political warfare where there are no holds barred in the lengths that the other side is going to try to poison our body politic. And of course, one of the important vectors of that becomes the media, becomes the general echo chamber that's created, that starts taking on a life of its own, completely separate from reality. I mean, it's sort of one thing to look at what's on the page, to compare it what's on another page, and determine that the evidence is ridiculous or pathetic. That is all well and good. But when it gets ramped up and decorated and repeated and over again, it takes on a separate life from the actual logic or reason that might be attached to a reasonable exercise. And so that's where it becomes dangerous. I don't actually think it can work, but they are certainly trying, and they are doing so, trying to change what we know, change what we learned a few years ago, and use that to try to manipulate the future. I mean, this is sort of very Orwellian, these echoes, of course.
Well, let me just suggest it's actually Hitlerian in the sense that the guy was the both the man who coined the term and who practiced it relentlessly of the big lie. And it seems to me that's very much at work here, no?
Exactly. But in terms of the notion of playing with the past in order to control the future does become Orwell, not just in a book, but the game plan. And just look, for example, at what has happened with the sort of biggest big lie that has now been essentially made official, and that would be how we get to the point of believing in, I don't believe it, but in terms of everyone else, it seems, believing that the Russians interfered in our election to elect Donald Trump. I mean, this is the basis of his delegitimization in the pages, not just of the newspaper, but of history. That is an ongoing project that I think is very important to think of, not in terms of the daily news feed or even the next 6 or 8 or 12 months, but going forward in the future. Donald Trump was duly elected by the American people, and the entire effort against him is also aimed at making that election a Russian operation. And this goes back, of course, to the completely concocted evidence, I use the word loosely, that the Russians hacked the DNC server and began this whole Russia collusion, just fandango or mess or fraud. And that is not a proven thing. And yet everybody from William Barr to Robert Mueller to even the House Republican report on what happened, the Russian interference in the campaign, all of it enshrine this, and it only continues to be enshrined even in the pages of the FISA, recent FISA IG report, which isn't even sourcing it, really. It's just kind of conventional wisdom. So this is very important.
Well, let me ask you, Dinah, we've talked about that on a number of occasions, and I think you're absolutely right. It's vital, and getting to the bottom of, you know, the fact that the FBI failed to do the basic forensic analysis that would underpin such a conclusion with respect to the DNC servers would seem to me just one of the things that should have featured prominently in Michael Horowitz's report, rather than just, you know, as you say, considering as a given that this is true. What did you make of his report, Diana? We talked about it again with Hans a little bit, but I'd be interested in your assessment.
I don't claim to have read all 400 and some pages, but everything I have read and learned about it, it seems like a massive amplification of the key facts we already knew from the 4-page memo that came out in early 2018 from Devin Nunes's Intelligence Committee. In other words, we learned that the mechanism for this spying on the Trump team was indeed a fraudulent use of a fraudulent document, the Steele dossier, by the FBI, by the Justice Department, by the FISA court. I mean, I'm sure that they are culpable in this as well. That's sort of an uninvestigated aspect of this whole thing. But we learned essentially that what we already knew for almost 2 years was indeed confirmed.
Yeah. Namely, that the FBI did engage in illegal activity and did so cognizant, at least at the highest levels, that it was doing it on the basis of a fraudulent document, the so-called Steele dossier, and that it was basically manipulating investigations and findings of investigations and the like in order to fit the predetermined narrative that Donald Trump was guilty of collusion and warranted close investigation by that agency. If I summarized it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And when we go back to that early 2018 period, now Donald Trump himself declassified that House Intelligence Committee memo of four pages. And this at the time was looked on by John McCain, then living, Nancy Pelosi, everyone else on that sort of never Trump and left side of the spectrum, and all the TV and cable pundits, etc., creating this huge, I mean, I've never actually seen anything quite like that particular eruption, movement claiming that releasing this information would be serving Vladimir Putin's interests. I mean, this was literally the message from the John McCain's office, literally what Nancy Pelosi called that memo, a bouquet for Vladimir Putin. I mean, this is how they were twisting that piece of thankful reality. I mean, frankly, I think that four-page memo is probably the most important document we have out of this entire several-year process. If Devin Nunes had not failed to roll over and play swamp and actually go along to get along, as almost everyone does in those positions in on Capitol Hill of either party, but certainly often Republicans, I'm afraid to say, we would really be nowhere, because I can't imagine that we would have even gotten to the point where we are of revelation on this thing. That's the document. I don't know what this giant FISA thing adds to it, except this terrible morass of a kind of a litany of criminal behavior that the inspector general took it on himself to kind of cleanse as no bias and unintentional. So we have the inspector general essentially declaring the FBI the Keystone Cops, and all of these terrible crimes against our democratic process are just mistakes. And I mean, that I don't think I've even processed yet. It is so horrifying. So this is where we are.
Interestingly, Diana, Hans was saying that, you know, it's sort of one line that's been interpreted that way. And yet, much as you were horrified by it, obviously the Attorney General and John Durham, the U.S. Attorney in Connecticut, were pretty horrified about it, so much so that they decided they needed to issue sort of correctives to clarify their findings, really speak to this issue of criminal activity, not just Keystone Cop. Diana, we're out of time. I'm so appreciative of yours, and thank you for sharing it with us. I hope you'll do so again next week. Next up, we'll speak with Robert Charles. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. It's a pleasure to say, joined by a man I respect greatly. He is a former Assistant Secretary of State in the George W. Bush administration. His name is Robert Charles. He has quite a resume in government service, starting as a naval intelligence officer, and then stints at the Reagan and George H.W. Bush White Houses, as well as, of course, most recently, his service in the George W. Bush administration at the State Department. He is the principal in the Charles Group and the author of a terrific book, Eagles and Evergreens. It's always a pleasure to catch up with him, pick his brains a little bit. Welcome back, Robert. Glad to have you with us.
Frank, thank you, and thank you for what you do for America.
Thank you for what you do for America. It's great to have you be part of our team as well. Let me ask you, as I have our other guests today, to reflect on what is going on in the House Judiciary Committee as we speak, and what is likely to flow from their deliberations, including next week, we're told, on the floor of the House of Representatives.
Well, Frank, I'll share with you that I have tried very hard to track this. I feel sick to my stomach as I watch and listen to what's transpiring It's as if these Democrats live in a these House Democrats live in an alternate universe. There is no legal basis. There isn't even a strong political basis. There isn't even a bipartisan hook to hang your hat on in these two articles of impeachment. The first one, of course, involves essentially a president and ultimately wider administration personnel seeking information on criminal justice matters that seem completely appropriate under the Ukraine-U.S. Treaty of 2000 and essentially exercising foreign policy prerogatives. And we've talked about that before. The second one is something called obstruction of Congress, which actually is an invented term. They just made that up. There is no such thing. Obstruction of justice is obviously a bar they can't meet. And so it's really not only distressing in a sort of an immediate way that we have a president who was duly elected and now they want to strip the American people of their franchise and they want to oust him on a purely political or personal basis. It's worse than that because it lowers the bar for impeachment for all future time if this goes through. I will say that there are two Democrats, Jeff Van Drew, Democrat of New Jersey, Colin Peterson, Democrat of Minnesota, who clearly said they're not going to go for this. There is a group of 10 who met on Monday who are apparently thinking about dodging, and they include Josh Gottmeyer, Democrat New Jersey, Kurt Schrader, Democrat Oregon, Anthony Vincini, Democrat New York, and Ben McAdams, Democrat Utah. If they peel off, then you've got six gone, and if you get 11 more out of 233, they can't pass impeachment, which would lead probably with the sort of fig leaf of a censure motion, which at least prevent impeachment. But this is terrible in two fronts, Frank. One is that it's an opportunity cost. We're not getting good and important things done, like appropriations, the budget, treaties. Those are not happening all the time that this is happening. And the other is that this is opening up to our adversaries. Last time this kind of thing happened, 9/11 followed on the heels of an investigation that sort of distracted the country. And I will tell you right now, we're in a worse position right now. There is no basis. Foreign adversaries are looking at this and laughing, and it's a disgrace.
Let me ask you, Bobby, because you have, as I say, quite a pedigree in the national security space as a practitioner as well as an observer and analyst and commentator. This has become a central contention of the left and the House Democrats specifically, that the extraordinary measures that they're taking are warranted because what the president has done in this phone call with the president of Ukraine has compromised the national security of the United States. And I'd like to ask your professional judgment on that topic.
So my professional judgment will be pinned only to facts. And the fact is that amounts to a nonsensical argument. Why? Because this president released 200 Javelin missiles and 37 launchers in 2018, long before this phone call to Ukraine. That's 100% more than Obama released in 8 years. He then released in October of 2019 an additional 150 Javelin missiles and an additional two launchers. There is no question that this president has done more to protect the national security of Ukraine and, frankly, therefore, of the United States in rebuffing Russian military influence. I would flip that on its head and say that the best time in the world, unfortunately, for our adversaries to take aggressive acts against us is when we are disunified. And for the next month, at least, we're going to be disunified in a very palpable, obvious way. I would hate to see not only another 9/11 kind of event occur, but I would hate to see Russia decide this is the right time to move in on the Baltics or on Georgia or China move on Taiwan or China crack down on Hong Kong, because the unification that is required, the unity that is required of America to respond immediately to that kind of thing and to rebuff it wouldn't be there. And so our adversaries are not stupid. They are our adversaries, but they're not stupid. And they see us disunified by these Democrats that are just chasing their own political fortunes. And I think it's worse than that. This is foreign policy and national security and impeachment based on raw emotion instead of facts and rational thinking. And that's not good for America.
Amen. Let me switch gears. As I have with our previous guests, I want to get your, again, professional assessment, Robert Charles, of what was The upshot of Michael Horowitz, the Inspector General of the Department of Justice, in his recently released report about the FBI's conduct specifically with respect to the FISA court.
So the short version is that he found 17 omissions or commissions of error in the application for that FISA warrant, which would have caused most observers to say, well, there was obvious political bias in this because that's the motivation. That's the theory of the case, why you have all these errors, why you didn't tell the court about the origins of the information you were providing to them, why you didn't provide them with Brady and Jenks material, which would have shown there was no probable cause or would have undermined any surveillance, why you didn't show the court that when you put confidential informants against the Trump campaign, they came back saying there was no Russia collusion. Instead of finding what you wanted them to find, they found the reverse. All of that went dead and silent. And I think the reality is this IG has to live in the four corners of that building, and he didn't want to be viewed as political. And so he also operated, incidentally, again, only within the four corners of that building. So he can look at FBI files. He can look at DOJ files. He has no power of subpoena. He has no power to impanel a grand jury. My guess is that you're going to see 50 times as much information flow out of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Connecticut. In fact, I believe they probably already, right now, the reason that Barr and that U.S. Attorney reacted so strongly to the IG report is they already have indictments in their scope. I suspect very strongly that we're going to see name-recognizable people get indicted here in the next 3 or 4 months. And I think it's unfortunate. They have to let this impeachment thing die down, but you can't obstruct something that was itself an obstruction. So I think what we're going to learn is that Durham is on the scent of the trail, and this IG was really not courageous enough to say what he knew.
Let me just ask you about how extraordinary it was that you had a U.S. attorney respond to this report in that way. I mean, you've I think, drawn the right conclusion as to why he felt compelled to do it, but this is a most unusual development, is it not?
So I think it is unusual, but it's not political. And I think you have to understand, and I only worked briefly in the Southern District of New York at one point, but, you know, the short version of this is that he is in the midst of a massive, very well-grounded, legally premised investigation. It has taken him all over the world. It has taken him to names that the average American would never know, that I don't know, I'm sure. I have heard through the grapevine that he has interviewed hundreds of people, that this is going to lead somewhere. And I think when you see essentially an amateur step to the plate, you know, without the ability to reach to the information that this U.S. attorney has been able to reach to, he felt compelled to say, look, don't take the IG's report to the bank. It isn't so much that the IG is wrong. It's that the IG has failed to see what I can see over the horizon. And you, the American people, need to know that. I think he might have also been trying to send a signal to the Senate saying, don't think that this IG's report is the final word.
Right. Which, of course, is going to be important to how the Senate proceeds with respect to the whole handling of this impeachment business. And Bobby, it's going to be something we'll be talking about, I'm sure, in the weeks ahead. Thank you for your time today. Come back to us again next week, perhaps after some of the dust has settled, and we'll visit with you further about it then. In the meantime, I know you'll keep up the good work with the Charles Group, and thanks for joining us. I want to say thank you to the rest of you for doing the same. I hope you'll do it again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.